like you said, climate can be sexy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Climate can be sexy.
Hanging with Rami Malek, saving the planet, no big deal.
No, but it's like, it's cool. Saving the planet, that's sexy.
Right, right.
You know when like voting became sexy? It's like, this is on another level of like, yeah, being an engaged citizen, that's sexy. Having a viable planet, like, sexy. Right.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Yes or no? Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
I had no prior knowledge of the planned assault on Nancy Kerrigan.
I am deeply sorry for my irresponsible and selfish behavior I engaged in.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to Oops the Podcast. I am Giulio Gallerati, joined as ever by my trusty cohort, Ryan Lynch.
Giulio.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Guys, as promised, today we have a very special guest. She is a journalist and climate optimist. I think climate optimist, when I saw that, I was like, ooh, this is exactly the person that we need here because we are hoping for some optimism. Anyway, Harvard named her one of the top climate communicators of 2022. She was awarded Refinery 29's Sustainable Innovator Award. She's a global correspondent for the Earthshot Prize. Please give it up for Sophia Lee, everybody.
Woo.
Good to see you. Thanks for coming on the show. This is great.
This is so great. We're having a blast.
We're having a blast. You know, Sophia was joking that this is a comedy podcast and that, you know, climate content is not necessarily particularly funny. So everybody brace yourselves. But hopefully we will have some hope at the end of this episode as well.
Climate can be sexy, but maybe not funny.
Sexy we like.
Yeah.
Sexy can be better than funny. We'll take it.
Yeah,
we'll
there take you go. Sexy.
So anyway, so we have like some random personal connections that are not necessarily important, but I do know that before you ended up on the path that you are currently on, it appears that you were on a less sort of climate focused path. At what point did you decide that this was sort of your calling and how did you end up in this field?
Yeah, good question. So yeah, you're like,
come on.
It's
a good, let's go.
Yeah, I'm the interviewer.
Let's go.
Yeah. I think that everyone's path will intersect with climate at some point. Mm-hmm. Mine just came earlier. Mm-hmm. Everyone's will, because it's the biggest transition that modern society has ever gone through. Mine just started earlier. I've always been in some sort of storytelling. So before, I actually worked at a magazine, mm-hmm. and it was very much a different magazine. I worked at Vogue. So when you think about Vogue, it's a fashion editorial. Mm-hmm. We did try to cover current events, politics, different things like that. But I think that I like to say everyone has a climate story, and the more familiar you are in unearthing your climate story, the more actually you could be serve the climate movement.
Interesting. So if you've experienced something, basically.
Not that if you've experienced something, and that can be a lot of it. For a lot of climate youth activists, it's, I experienced this climate disaster.
Right, right.
It could even just be like, where did you grow up? And what was that ecosystem like? Mm-hmm. What was that biosphere? What were your ideologies growing up? What was the nature that you were constantly in awe of? What is your relationship with nature, mm-hmm. and humans? You know, we are nature ourselves. We right. often forget that. So, and for me, I didn't realize it until I was, you know, in my late 20s, just how much of my climate story and my upbringing really just contributed to my perspective of the world. So I come from either a long line of farmers or, on the other side of my family, a long line of Buddhists. So growing up, it was always like we had this deep connection with food, with soil. It was also because of Buddhism. It was also Buddhism is more this philosophy for life rather than a religion. It's this symbiosis that you have with all living things, this equilibrium, this mutual relationship you have. So I thought that everyone grew up with this perspective. And then, you know, coming to New York, working in these roles where it's a lot of overconsumption, and the climate crisis started because of capitalism and these systems of overconsumption and capitalism. And a lot of the jobs and work we do, it's all late stage capitalism. It's like having you buy something, it's having you feel less than, so you can validate yourself with products, or, you know, it's an aspirational lifestyle, but it's telling you that you your baseline is not good enough. When sustainability is telling us your baseline is already enough.
Right. And those two things seem very at odds with each other. And we talked about that on the last episode where it's like
the paradox.
We want to overhaul everything, but how do you do that? Because in the short term, and it's not even that necessarily short term, it's all time's about perspective, right? So like this entire generation might end up having their entire world flipped on their head in a world where we need to like transition out of certain businesses, like farming or like changing the way that we do all of these things. So I want to talk more about that because even just talking to you for 30 seconds, I have like 1,000 questions. I'm like, oh my God. But I want to ask you really quickly about the Earthshot Prize, which is something that you work on. Because I've heard of it and I know that it's like did Prince William start it?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
So can you just explain a little bit to us what that is? And then from there we can get into some like deep climate discussion.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes.
The Earthshot Prize is something that was started by Prince William, but also by an incredible cohort of climate experts, David Attenborough, Christiana Figueres, all these climate experts basically came together and they were like, we need to have a Nobel Peace Prize for climate solutions. Mm-hmm. We need to honor them. We need to champion their solutions. We need to finance it. And it's not a philanthropic thing. It's really just making sure these very pivotal climate solutions have the stadium and the position in order to scale and the network and also financial backing. And it's an incubator program. It's an award ceremony that has like the glitz and glam and celebs so people can pay attention. But at the end of the day, it's really just getting climate solutions that are very dire and necessary and getting them out there.
Right. That's cool. Yeah, I saw you like on the red carpet interviewing people and stuff, which was cool. It's like you said, climate can be sexy.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Climate can be sexy.
Hanging with Rami Malek, saving the planet, no big deal.
No, but it's like, that's cool. Saving the planet, that's sexy.
Right.
You know when like voting became sexy? It's like, this is on another level of like, being an engaged citizen, that's sexy. Having a viable planet, like, sexy. Right.
And it's smart to also additionally make it sexy because we're all fickle and stupid and we need something to make us pay attention. Ooh, look what she wore.
Right.
The red carpet of the Earthshot Prize. Sorry.
Yeah.
Hilarious. But that's great. Okay. So in your opinion, so you say like these solutions and things that can work. Does the technology exist to make all of these changes that we would need to make in a perfect scenario?
Yeah. 1,000%.
Like for sure.
Yeah.
And what is the main blocker of all of this being able to happen quickly?
Mental will and capitalism.
Politics?
I mean, politics is all part of it,
right,
too. It's just, it boils down to money and power.
Right.
And that is politics. That could be government. That could be, you know, financial gain. That could trickle down to so many other things.
Right. And you were at the like COP28 summit, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So for example, in my brain, I see a summit like this. Okay.
Yeah.
We all show up, we agree to do the zero emissions thing and everybody leaves, or net zero, whatever. Sorry if I'm not using the right terminology.
Yeah.
And then we leave and suddenly some of these important countries are suddenly not doing what they said. Is that a common thing?
Yeah, that's a common thing. Well, I mean, this is why I think it's so hard for people to even access climate, because even what you just said there, there's a truth in it, but then there's also so many other truths that exist within it.
This is what we need here. This is good.
So with COP, first off, COP itself, it stands for Conference of the Parties. It's governed by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC. UN Climate Change.
Okay.
They're rebranding because no one understands what UNFCCC is.
You're right.
That's the whole
thing. Does it have anything to do with Paris? Wasn't Paris the other?
Yes. Oh, so basically the Paris Climate Agreement that came out of COP15, that was the biggest global climate agreement that has happened. Yeah. So that was a big deal because there were multiple signatories meaning countries represented and signed on to the Paris Climate Agreement saying that they will limit their emissions within 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm. Or to keep us within 1.5?
To keep us within, exactly. Okay. So the thing is that it's the UN technically who is they're the framework, but it's not legally binding. It's not like the UN has any,
right?
If you don't do that, if the US goes 2 times over that, it's
sadly, yeah.
Right. It's a commitment, it's a public commitment, And so, you know, hopefully that's why as citizens, we should be holding our governments accountable right. for it, because they made these public commitments. So, yeah, I'll stop there, because there's so much else that comes from these conferences. That's like,
right.
Okay. But again, these conferences, it's also like a really complex calculus of like costs and benefits, because there's a huge cost of like, it's 100,000 people. It's like the biggest climate conference. You fly people all around the world. Like now even Biden and Kamala, you know, now high official government leaders come. Before mm-hmm. when it was COP, you know, 10, 12, right. this wasn't as big of a deal.
Got it. So more people.
And it's a lot of politics. And a lot of times it's so much PR greenwashing. So you'll have like Coca-Cola sponsoring it, or you have like a fossil fuel company sponsoring it. And you're like, wait, Coca-Cola, number one plastic waste, fossil fuels. This COP28 was super contentious because the COP president ended up being the president of UAE's national oil company.
Right. Classic.
So then it was just like, but then, so that was like a huge hypocritical complex thing to navigate. The climate community was so upset about that. But then at the end of the COP28, at the end of the 2 weeks, they finally were able to add these two little words called fossil fuels into the final draft agreement, which that has never happened before in history. And then some people in the climate community was like, see, well, now we have this. And some people, there's a lot of skepticism too from like island nations and scientists. Right. But then other people are like, well, this has never happened before where we had fossil fuels in the final draft agreement.
So that's a hopeful development.
It's hopeful, yeah. But that's the thing with climate, is that it's so paradoxical and it's such a catch-22 at all times, because you're literally talking about uprooting every system we know.
Right.
And completely shifting it.
Right.
And so that's not going to come easy. Right. And the biggest companies and the biggest governments at play that have power and financial incentive, like, they're not going to shift overnight. And it's so obvious. The science has been so obvious for 30 years. And it's like, if it was all about the science, we would have made these changes, but it's not. It's about.
Right. Right. So we know what we need to do, but doing it is just like extremely difficult,
because
we're all addicted to the way that we live.
Yeah. We're just like, we don't even know that there is a world outside of the systems that we live in right now.
Right.
Like, you wouldn't even know what it would mean to like have a company. If you were a founder of a fast growing company that was a public trade company on the New York Stock Exchange, and you were like, I'm actually going to pick degrowth, and I'm going to tell all my board and my advisors, and, you know,
it's the hot term right now.
Yeah. Right. That we're not going to meet any trajectory. We're not going to have any growth. Like, people would think you're crazy.
And, right.
Yeah.
How do you do it? And suddenly now I have my own chickens in my backyard. And I'm the one cutting them. I have bones in every bite. I'm like, this sucks, dude. You know what I mean? But just like, as an example, I know that's extreme, but like, it requires consumerism to kind of like very much stop progressing in the wrong direction, right? We are consuming so much. We're eating too much. We're driving too much. We're doing everything a lot.
Yeah. And it seems like people are always like, oh, degrowth, it means the world's going to have to stop and we have to stop buying. And, you know, if we don't have economy, then we don't have, you know, infrastructure and all these resources. And the whole thing is that people take it to such binaries, and it's like, oh, if we do this, then our world will collapse. But it's actually not that at all. It's really just this gradual change that is a very necessary change anyways. Like, we were never living in a sustainable way since the industrial era. Right. So it's like, and also, we can have the mental will, because if you look at what happened during COVID, we were able to shut down all like production and governments and all of this within a month. The entire world shut down, and it was obviously due to this virus, but we had the mental will to do that. We just don't, like, to save our planet in 30 years, we don't have the mental will to do that. To save our planet in the next year when it came to COVID,
right?
We did have the mental will. Right. And that's like the hard thing with the climate crisis as well, is that people can't think that far ahead because we're so also addicted to this like 24-hour news cycle, 24-hour financial system. Right. Yeah.
Let's be real. Investing can be intimidating. So intimidating that sometimes it feels easier to just push it off. If you can identify with that, today's sponsor might be just the thing to kick you into gear. Today's episode is sponsored by Acorns. Acorns helps you automatically save and invest for your future. You don't need a lot of money to get started. You can even start by investing your spare change with Roundups. The app even gives you access to education and guidance to learn more about investing. Head to acorns.com/oops to sign up for Acorns to start saving and investing for your future today. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. Please consider your objectives, risk tolerance, and Acorns fees before investing. Acorns Advisors, LLC, Acorns, is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are provided to clients of Acorns by Acorns Securities, LLC, member FINRA/SIPC. For more information, visit acorns.com. I've been reading, and I don't know if this is true, but I've been reading that like China has been pretty committed to the net zero initiative. In your opinion, like, would you say that's true? Would you say that there are certain big countries with big economies that are stars of pushing this movement forward versus others?
China is a huge leader in renewables. They're really trying to amp that up, but also they're one of the biggest emitting countries as well. The U.S. and China, top two emitting countries.
Two biggest economies, makes sense.
Two biggest economies, mm-hmm. two biggest emitters. So if there should be stars, it should be the U.S. and China. Mm-hmm. China is just doing so much more in that space. But yeah, I think countries that also sign on to the fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, they should be the stars. But they're, you know, people wouldn't even care about them because they're not G20. They're just...
Right.
So anyways, that's a whole other conversation.
Okay.
I guess it's like we shouldn't put any country on a pedestal because it's like, and right now everyone's like, oh, but we'll sign on if China signs on right. and the US signs on, and it's just going to be this ongoing battle, and it would actually be more collective power if like every other country besides US and China agree to it. Then we still actually, that would be enough momentum as well.
Got it.
So it's just hard in the climate movement to put any person or country on a pedestal like that.
Cool. Okay, so this leads to my next question. So let's say that, so degrowth is this popular movement. What if, is there a world where we don't need to change the way we do things and we're able to kind of use some of this new technology that's emerging, including from the Earthshot Prize participants, et cetera. I was reading stuff about, you know, being able to take CO2 and put it in soil.
Yeah.
Or the stuff where you can take it and use it to power other things. Like, is there a possibility that capitalism and climate change can be in bed together, whereas we're finding out new businesses and new ways to make money off of trying to save the planet?
I'm going to say no, because that's like every capitalistic's like biggest wish, and like that's like kind of the thing that every fossil fuel executive is also pushing. Like, we could keep going and burning fossil fuels at the rate that we are now while also doing carbon capture. They always use this like one carbon capture study. It's just like, the thing is that at this rate that we're going to, even if we had all these solutions, they were all implemented, they were all scaled and funded, it's like, we really just need to ask ourselves, do we even want to continue with a society like this? Like, even if it was possible, like hypothetically, it was fine and the earth could sustain this and our biosphere could sustain this. Like right now, like, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm like, this isn't even a society that is fun or sustainable or I would want my kids to grow up in, because like, basically it's like, I don't even know the statistic, but almost 80% of the world, their basic human needs aren't even met. Like their basic fundamental human rights of just clean air, clean water, like access to food. And that's not even met. Our biosphere is completely being destructed. So it's like, do we even want to continue with this? Like, this is almost like the thing is like, it's an illusion. These systems that we're so addicted to, who are they really serving?
Right.
And do we even enjoy them?
Besides like the rich countries. But one person might argue that like, say India, for example, who's like a big polluter, right?
Yeah.
Like they're in their like industrial phase. And once they sort of graduate from that and the, you know, economic growth model becomes less important to their economy, like when the economy slows down, they'll be able to transition into a more responsible way of being, the way that China plans to, the way that the US does. Is that nonsense?
I mean, I just think that these are just such simplistic answers to some very complex topics that also we're talking not even about, like, just putting all the solutions aside. Mm-hmm. We're talking about like human psychology right now. And the psychology of completely shifting an entire society. And we haven't experienced any of this since like the Industrial Revolution. And I would like to believe, which is why I believe I'm a climate optimist, that all of this, the climate crisis and everything, it's leading up to something bigger than just like us being like, cool, we close the ozone layer and we reverse and we reach net zero and there's no more greenhouse gas emissions, but everything still stays the same. I would like to think that this is actually pushing us to this trajectory where we're actually shifting as a society of how we live. And don't get me wrong, like, I live in New York. I love living in the city. I travel on a plane, you know, like, I'm not like gonna go and live in like a hunter gatherers. Like, a lot of times people think like, oh, that means you want to go back to like this nomadic era. And it's like, no, I want to continue this lifestyle, but in a way that's actually sustainable. Right. And so, you know, a lot of like anthropologists, they talk about the planetary era, which is basically we used to, right now we're in the empire era, which things are linear, they're hierarchical, there's so many different things. And we, like, the climate crisis, the hope is that it's pushing us into the planetary era, right, where things are circular. It's the collective over the individual. And you see that with our ideology and our thoughts and how we, even just like the explosion of health and wellness and all of that, like, from a ideological standpoint, I think a lot of us are operating on this planetary era ideology, right, but you know, our systems are still in the empire era where it's like very linear.
Right. Right. So it's not quite mainstream, but like, we can see a little glimpse of what it might look like if we were to start just like being more mindful about this, as far as, you know, trying to make a push to live slightly more sustainable lives at the very least. And sometimes when I'm doing stuff like that, I'm like, is this even helping? Like,
it doesn't matter if it's helping. It's just, I'm like, always tell people, like, it doesn't matter if it's helping and it's okay if you mess up, but it's literally to tell you and your mental will and changing your own human psychology that something you that have matters. Control and it matters.
Right.
Because if you give up on it, like, apathy is actually the worst thing.
Right.
Like, I would rather you be a climate denier than be completely climate apathetic.
Fuck,
yeah. Because then I can't really change your mind.
Right.
If you're in a relationship, like, if they're angry, then you know they actually care.
Right.
But if they just don't care, then they just like, then you're this not even good. Committed. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, then you
can't win them back if they don't care.
You can't win them back if they don't care. So I'm like, I would rather you be a denier, because then I can like actually give you the tangible evidence and reasoning to help you change your mindset.
Right. Right.
But most people actually, I think it was like Yale School of Climate Change, they said that 70% of Americans are climate deniers, which it's like not climate deniers. Like, the majority of Americans, they believe in the science of climate change, but they're like, oh, I got jobs. Like,
right. Exactly. Yeah. What am I going to do?
What am I going to do? It's like 50 years out from now. Like, I'm delaying it. And it's like, how do we activate this huge majority of Americans and activate them into this movement?
Interesting. Okay. So in your opinion, is it possible that we could continue living exactly the way that we are? We don't enter any treaties, whatever, and that somehow it won't affect anything. That's an honest question.
I mean, maybe you coming as like, we have a lot of carbon privilege living in the US and North America and in the West. A lot of carbon privilege.
What does that mean?
It's like a term that I basically say, like, instead of white privilege, like, we have carbon privilege. We have access to way more carbon. Like, emissions of carbon is like 10 times more than someone living in the global South.
Right.
So that's you didn't choose to, you know, be born in Connecticut, and you didn't choose to be born, you know, it's like white privilege, but you have carbon privilege.
Right.
So if we don't do anything, like, yeah, it's going to impact us so much in a way that, I mean, like, maybe us in the global North will have a little bit more time, like a few years, but even just like the things we're seeing from last year was the hottest summer on record.
It's going to be again, right? They say,
I mean,
we'll see.
So it's just like a lot of the things that are happening now, climate scientists thought that would happen in 5-10 years,
right,
and it's already happening.
Right.
So
which
we
is
have
worrying.
No idea. Like, 1/3 of all days in 2023, I think, were above 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Right.
Which for Americans, that's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. I feel like that's
an increase
or that threshold. Mm. I feel like that's a really confusing thing, because we say 1.5 degrees Celsius a lot, but Americans don't really get that. Right. Do you get that?
Yeah, I have my phone in Celsius on purpose to like try to be bilingual.
Bilingual. Yeah.
Bilingual in the temperature. Yeah. It doesn't always work. I'm converting still semi-regularly, but I'm getting better at it.
Oh, nice.
It's been
okay.
2 years now.
Yeah.
So,
cool.
The 1.5, it lands here.
Thank yeah. you. I think everyone's like, oh, 1.5. And it's like, that's 2.7
right.
Fahrenheit, which, you know, that is on a global level. That's actually a huge increase.
It's significant to me because I've been told by experts that it is. So I'm like, okay, it's significant. You know what I mean? Like, I don't specifically understand the threshold, but I don't know that that matters. I'm just like, maybe it does, but I'm like, okay, we all need to slow down. Let's hope that this works, because it seems as if once we cross into that territory, what everybody's saying, and you can tell me if I'm interpreting this correctly, is that sort of there's no turning back from that moment potentially, or is that not accurate?
No, that there is a point of no return where climate scientists actually can't predict what happens, because then our climate truly goes into this, I guess, spiral of catastrophes that we have no idea. We don't know. Climate scientists can't say that because we've never experienced anything like that.
Right.
And it's like, can you imagine, we are the generation that brings about this doom and spiral of climate catastrophe. I guess a good thing to understand is like the difference between 1.5 degrees and 2 degrees, which doesn't seem that much difference, is like the survival of all of our coral reefs. Like, that's a huge part.
Right.
And that 0.5 degrees doesn't seem like a lot to us, but like our ocean increasing by that much, like that changes a lot. And also when we're talking about every 0.0001 degree in reversing, like maybe we won't reach 1.5 degrees within 2030, but even if we can reverse any minuscule part of that degree, we're talking about millions of lives being saved.
Right.
So,
and yeah. So what people, I think too, like maybe this isn't obvious, and correct me if I'm saying anything wrong, but like the coral reefs not existing is a very bad thing, because there's a chain reaction if there's any massive change to any ecosystem.
Yeah.
And on that mass scale, like then the fish are gone, which affects stuff with the ocean. I can't talk about specifically what that chain reaction is, but I've watched enough shows about mass extinction to like understand that something could happen that we don't even know about.
Yeah. And like we're already in our sixth mass extinction. So like basically human caused climate crisis. So we have the solutions, and like, I'm just like, nature, corals are super resilient. They could come back to life. They could regenerate after like 100 years after being dead, scientists have found.
Cool.
So like nature might be able to have another wave, but it's like, we're talking about, like, we're not doing, yes, we're doing this for nature, but like, I don't think people understand. It's like, we're also doing this for the survival of literally humanity.
Right. Right. Okay. So let me ask you this. So every time I watch something, it's like a nature show specifically, I'm like, oh, this is great. And then the last 10 minutes is like, we're all fucked. And then you're like, okay, that sucks. And then they're like, but it's not too late. I've been hearing it's not too late for a really long time. And I'm getting to the point where I'm like, am I going to turn one of these on? They're going to be like, it's too late. Sorry, dude. Like, at what point is it going to be too late? Do we have time? Is there time to stop this from spiraling in a bad direction?
Yes. If we're alive, we have time.
Okay, that's good.
Again, that 0.0001 degree of reversing, that represents millions of people's lives.
Right.
And so why wouldn't we fight for that, you know?
Totally.
And I think Al Gore, oh, I had it pulled up. Al Gore has his whole talk that he talks about this actually a lot, where there's actually some new research that came up last year. There was research that said once we truly reach what is called net zero. Do you understand what net zero means?
Yeah, it's like we are like polluting like equally to the amount that we are conserving.
So once we truly get to net zero, the temperatures on Earth will almost stop going up immediately. It's like flipping a switch. This is Al Gore's whole thing, the research that he talks about, that came just literally, I think, this past fall. And the lag time will be as little as 3 to 5 years. So climate scientists use the lag time of basically our climate increasing temperatures. So climate scientists used to think we would keep going on these positive feedback loops, but actually the lag time is in 3 to 5 years, which is like a huge scientific evidence that this is like really flipping the switch. Like, our, I mean, I just like how brilliant is our climate and our biosphere that it could self-regulate like that. Oh, yeah. It's like your, it's like if your body got sick, like when you get the flu and you have this high, high, high temperature. And you know, when you're so sick in bed and then you sweat it out and you break the sweat and then all of a sudden your body temperature self-regulates. That's literally, that's exactly what would happen to our biosphere, like our Earth.
If we hit that net zero.
If we hit, truly hit that net zero.
And 2030 is the year?
2030 is the like goal, because at this point we're already, I don't want to say this because, but at this point we are surpassing 1.5 in the 2030s. And then also there's other science that says, and if we stay at true net zero for year after year, within 25 to 30 years, half of the human caused greenhouse gas emissions will have fallen out of the atmosphere and this long healing process begins. Like that is such incredible science and data that we know, like
it's incredible.
And it's just like our, like I'm just like, are, like aren't you humbled that we live in such a brilliant ecosystem that it could do this? Like we've literally like beaten and destroyed and exploited and like just damaged this home that we love so much, mm-hmm. and then we completely, like it will completely forgive us if we could just reach net zero,
right? So that, yeah, so that's interesting. So when it's like, if we surpass the, some of these targets, we will enter territory where it's like, we don't know what's going to happen specifically, but it's going to be bad. So that's one thing. I mean, we do know specifically to some degree, but like we know that certain places will become uninhabitable because the water's going to rise too high, right? In the Pacific Island nations,
yeah.
Some of these other places. Also, we'll displace people who end up living in places that are uninhabitable. The poor people are going to suffer. They won't be able to afford to move. People will starve. People will die. All that, right? That's fair to say.
Yeah.
And I've also, this is a term that I've become familiar with recently, which I thought was an interesting one. Wet bulb temperature. Have you heard about this at all?
No.
It's some way to measure heat and humidity.
Oh, got it.
So like in a lot of these areas, like it is becoming so hot and humid that it's like people are going to start cooking outside in like soon, supposedly. I don't know.
I don't think a lot of people understand like how the warming of temperatures, like that changes so much. Like you get heat exhaustion. It's not just, it's like a slow
burn.
It's not just, it's also just not like sexy news. Like, oh, 50,000 people and, you know, in Southeast Asia died from extreme heat.
From being too hot.
But that's literally what happens, is heat exhaustion
and
extreme heat.
Interesting. No, but it's true. Like, and that's true too. Like when I travel a lot and I go to kind of sometimes places that people are afraid to visit. And I always tell people that my biggest fear is getting sick from eating food or like drinking bad water or something. That is always the biggest problem. Like getting kidnapped is like, it's sexier, but it's not as likely. You know what I mean? But it's the same thing with like the heat. People are scared of the plane crashing or whatever. But in reality, like there are things that are killing people on a way bigger scale.
Yeah.
I don't know, depending where you live, but interesting. Okay. So I've gathered two hopeful things from our conversation so far. One is that fossil fuel being officially noted in the COP28 documents is a significant breakthrough. There's some hope there. Great. Number two is that if we're able to hit some of our climate goals, it will immediately start to take effect and repair the damage that we have done. Great. Is there anything else that you got that is something that we can feel good about for the future if we are to do whatever it is we need to do?
Well, I actually think the most hopeful thing is that all of this is serving this larger purpose of completely shifting our society and bringing us into the planetary era. Mm-hmm. We, as a human society, we go through these 1,000-year trajectories of eras of how we think we will live and what is the norm, and then it completely shifts. Mm. Like imagine if you were, I don't know, a hunter-gatherer, and then it was like the Renaissance era, you know, and then the Renaissance happened. None of this is truly the norm. Like we think it's the norm. Even like single-use plastics, like it was only introduced in our parents' generation. Like before that, everyone had reusables, and it's just none of this is the norm. We think it's the norm, but none of it is. And I'm, what makes me hopeful is that all of this is serving this larger purpose of us shifting into a society that truly benefits you. Mm-hmm. And I don't know about anyone else, but I just feel like if you're living in a city like New York or in the global north and you're a young working person, like the thing that everyone tells you that gains you the most freedom is to work harder or to work more or financial gain. And it's just like this hamster wheel of late stage capitalism.
Bashing our heads against the wall and still not being happy, still not having enough.
Yeah, and like it's never enough. And then it's like, how backwards is it that like we work so hard, we work 80 hours a week, and then they're like, oh, but you also need to have this lifestyle. So then, and then you drown it out with all these other things like entertainment, TV.
Girls won't like you if you don't have that watch.
Right.
Buddy.
Right.
You better get that fucking watch. It's true.
What watch are you wearing?
Apple Watch. I like to think that I am
not
fairly
sponsored by Apple.
I don't like being marketed to. And granted, I have tons of stuff and I'm sure that they've got me. But like men's high-end goods, I refuse to participate.
No.
The car, the big car, the fancy watch, the bullshit. I have no interest in anything.
But like we're only receptive to marketing because we have this perception of the world that it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And that
Very capitalist.
And I don't think we realize like the day to day of how we're inundated by this every single day. Mm-hmm. And it becomes such the norm. And that in itself is unsustainable.
Right.
Not like from a marketing perspective or a business perspective. That's unsustainable within our own time, energy, and resources. And like the biggest myth is that the world was created for man.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, no, I'm sure. is that a like widely believed thing? I mean, like, I'm sure it is in general, maybe, but like I don't know anybody who's like would think that that is a groundbreaking thought, that that is not the case. Like, I don't believe the world was made for men.
No, but if you didn't think the world would, like, if you didn't think the world was made for men or humans.
Oh, for man, being man, animal, man.
Yes, like humans, like okay, humans,
okay.
Like
okay, okay.
Humanity.
For like
we are
man
like the
arrived.
Ultimate. No, not man. Like I'm talking about like mankind.
Okay, okay.
Yes.
I'm like, well, you know, man, that's funny.
I'm just saying, like, we wouldn't be like exploiting and using.
Totally get it. Yes.
Yes.
We've decided, and I watched the show on Netflix. I think it's called Life on Our Planet. Uh-huh. I don't know if you've seen it, but I felt that it did, and not to be cheapening some of these sophisticated things we're talking about, but I felt for the first time like the earth was not created for man watching that. I'm like, oh, we are like a small part of a long story and we are just an animal like these other animals. I'm like, this is fucking me up watching this. Like it was one of those like mind blown moments where I'm like, okay, all these mass extinctions and now we are like accelerating our path toward another one faster than it has ever happened. And that like really landed on me for the first time.
Yeah. Like that. we're bringing about our own mass extinction.
Right.
Yeah. Like hopefully evolution. Not. Yes. Hopefully not. That's the whole point is that we have
stop it.
So much autonomy in that.
We're all
but I think if we just kind of like humbled ourselves and being like, we're not like the ultimate creations of nature.
Right.
And it doesn't, we are part of nature. We're part of this ecosystem, but we're not like the end all be all. It doesn't end with us. Like mankind wasn't this most superior creation that nature is going to come up with.
Right. Well, it sounds as if because I had this question, but it may not apply where I'm like, is there some chance that on our current path, if all this stuff fails, Earth will become nearly uninhabitable in our lifetimes? Is the answer we don't know, or probably not, or like what do you have to say?
Uninhabitable for who? For mankind? For humanity?
Mankind.
For any living thing? For animals? Like it depends. Right?
For mankind is the question. And I know that goes against what we were just talking about, but like that is my thought. Like, is there a chance that I'm gonna have to like be worrying about where I'm gonna go because there's barely anywhere to go, and then my kids are gonna be doomed, and their kids, forget about it. They're not. My kids aren't even gonna have kids. Because their kids will be fucked.
I mean, I think the whole beautiful thing, it's like the dark romanticism of humanity right now is that we are actually at that very finite point where we can choose if
we can choose our own adventure.
Yeah, and we could choose if the world ends up being habitable or not.
Right. Wow.
So that's why crazy. I'm like, for everyone out there, I'm like, that's why climate is so sexy. I'm like, guys, we're literally choosing if humanity will survive for another like 5,000 years, etc.
Right. That's fun. That could be a funny video. Like you do a thing like about heroes and it's just a bunch of like scientists.
Yeah, do it.
Shit. That's fire. Okay. So question here, a thing that they talk about a lot is sort of like the 9 planetary boundaries.
Oh, yes.
And so we have supposedly crossed 6 of them. I know the 9 is a large number. So if you don't know it, like off the top of your head, it's all good. We can get Lynch in here involved. What are those boundaries?
They include things like ocean acidification.
Okay.
The ozone layer, I believe, was one of them. What are the other ones?
You want to read them?
Yeah,
these are very big words, some of them, so I'm going to struggle reading them.
Do it.
Lynch isn't a word reader.
Climate change, change in biosphere integrity, stratospheric ozone depletion, ocean acidification, like you mentioned, biogeochemical flows, land system change, freshwater use, atmospheric aerosol loading. Did I say that correctly?
I think I'm just laughing because these are just like aerosol? These are difficult terms.
Aerosol. I said it right.
Yeah, say it 5 times fast.
Aerosol.
There you go.
Those three.
Whoever introduction came up with this
of
list?
Damn, I was doing so well. I know this word. Introduction of novel entities. That's it. That's 9.
Can we come up with some layman's terms for these guys? I think that would help the cause.
We can just do an acronym, the CCSOBLFAI.
Casabalfi.
I mean, it just
that was good.
There you go.
Thank you.
I feel like what most people, like the average person, just needs to understand is that we have planetary boundaries, and just like we have human body boundaries, where if you push your body to a certain level, like imagine if you had high cholesterol, high blood pressure, high this, your body will shut down.
Right.
If you get to
a ticking time bomb.
Yeah. So that's kind of the same with our.
The planet has high cholesterol. The planet is overweight. The planet has been smoking. The planet is doing all. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Drinks all the time.
Yeah.
It's not calling their mom back. Like
stressful
whatever
you, work environment.
Yeah. Has a lot of undealt trauma. Doesn't go to therapy. I mean,
no friends.
You name it, right? Honestly, it's like actually, I mean, I feel like if you really look at how all the damage we're doing and how our Earth is still functioning and is still like the most miraculous place on Earth, like the fact that, you know, there is even intelligent life forms, like that's like so beautiful and romantic in itself.
Yeah,
that
worth
you would want worth saving. Yeah, sexy. See?
sexy.
Let's go. Sexy,
bringing sexy AF. Back sexy AF. So I've also heard that there's a bunch of things contributing to the climate progressing in a way that we don't want it to. Some of them are like obvious and I've been hearing about. I'm curious if there are other ones that I'm not thinking of. So the obvious ones like fossil fuel emissions, obviously. Secondly, commercial farming.
Yeah.
Those are like the two main ones that come to mind. There are other things where it's like, okay, that like ultimately impacts it, but not as directly as some of these other things. What are some other ones?
Farming loss, livestock is a big one. Yeah. Wait, just really fast. When we say fossil fuels, do you think the average person understands what that is?
I don't know. Oil, coal, burning it for energy and then polluting the environment because of it.
Also, I think people don't understand like fossil fuels. Like the reason why it's called fossil is like we're literally digging up.
Mining it.
Mining dead dinosaur bones.
Right.
And then the things that have been encapsulated into like the depths of our Earth for hundreds of thousands of years and then burning it. And then of course it's releasing emissions. Right. Like we're using like such expired, like it's just insane. And also like even that in itself, it became such the norm. But during this shift into the planetary era, it's like, I don't want to be burning this and breathing this in and have like, you know, that just seems like once you like really understand what it is and then you look at it, you're like, wait, what? We were doing what?
Right.
It just seems so dumb.
It's remarkable that we've even thought of it. Like, how did someone figure that out? Let's burn this and it'll make energy happen. I still don't even understand how that even works.
Right. And then we're like, yeah, let's just run with it. Let's like empower everything with just this. Right.
Oh, Alaska. Oh, there's oil. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go. Yeah. Like, let's go in the middle of the ocean and get it. Like, we're getting it everywhere. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And actually, there's like so many funny instances where, like, when Henry Ford and like when car automobiles were coming about, they actually had a combustion fuel engine and an electric engine, and they were testing both.
Interesting.
And one of them was going to be used for short-term distances, and one of them was going to be used for long-term. And they were going to introduce both. That was like something that, but then it ended up being to market. It was only combustion engines. Right. Like, imagine if that happened.
Different story, right?
Different story, yeah.
So, okay, but now that electric vehicles are becoming more pervasive, presumably in rich societies only, I don't know the statistics on that, but I know that China's making a big push on it. There's a bunch of them available here. You see Teslas, all these people are coming out with hybrids and electric vehicles. Is that like making any sort of progress in the direction that we want to be going in? Or is it just like a drop in the bucket?
No, it is because, well, okay, obviously EVs and batteries and the ethical mining of it, that comes with its own set of problems.
Right.
Just talking about the energy part of, does it make a difference? It is, because like you mentioned, China, Brazil, Indonesia, they're huge adopters. And then that means they also end up being huge adopters of renewable energy.
Right. And those are some of the most populated places in the world. So that's good if those kind of places can make those changes.
Exactly. And for also really, you know, countries with highly concentrated populations, they are using EV bikes. Like it's, sorry, not EVs, e-bikes. So right. It's like electric motorcycles, electric right. bikes. Like I was just in China and Asia, and there were so many bikes that, you know, everyone goes around on a little scooter or like right. a motorcycle. They're all electric now.
Because all the grids are fucked up and there's like terrible traffic, right? Probably like Indonesia, I've heard.
Yes,
it's like,
right.
You're stuck in traffic for like 10 hours.
Right. And, you know, we have to talk about, like, from a statistical standpoint, there's always an inflection point where once it reaches a certain inflection point, EV sales in 2022 was 20% of all
really?
Car sales.
That's great.
Yes.
That's positive.
And of all car sales. And that's an inflection point where after that happens, it just reaches mass adoption.
Like, right.
It's like a fashion trend. It's like everyone's wearing Crocs, and then once it reaches 20%, you know, like you see them everywhere, whatever.
Right.
So that happens with consumer behavior, and that's happening. And so that's more to say it's like making a difference in the sense that like it's showing us where we're heading.
Right. And so it's funny you mentioned that, because one of our partners, Reboot Eco, they're called, give them a free shout out here. They sell a bunch of kind of like sustainable household products, beauty products, whatever. And it's funny because all of the problems with like the beta versions of all of their products, they have now solved. We're in like the next step of it. And it feels like a similar thing with EV. As like time goes on, we're getting past the hurdles that are preventing people from buying them, where it's like the battery doesn't last as long, or it's a pain to charge it. Now there's chargers everywhere. With the same thing with some of these products, it's like, oh, the all natural deodorant doesn't work. Well, now it does. Oh, the wooden toothbrush gets moldy at the bottom. Now they've painted the bottom. Like, they're coming up with solutions. So that's good. Inflection point. I didn't know that term before, but I'm going to start adopting it now. Thank you.
Bring
it
into my mass sphere. Adoption.
Mass adoption. Uh-huh. So that's great. So this makes me feel encouraged, because in my head, I'm like, okay, electric vehicle sounds cool. But then I start to worry. I'm like, okay, well, when it's cold, the battery doesn't last as long. What if that's like a problem? You know what I mean? Like, I still want to do it, but I can't help but be selfish and think about how things are going to change my lifestyle. And of course, and I think I speak for the masses here, I'm going to be more likely to entertain a thing that allows me to live as close to how I normally do as possible.
Yes.
And maybe that's the wrong mindset and we need to get past that, but that's just my
thought. That's actually why the inflection point is so important for individual behavior, because people think, oh, my individual choices don't make a matter. But actually, you plus 7 billion people in the world, it actually does matter, and it does add up. So 20% inflection point for EV vehicle sales. There's also an inflection point for plant-based food and like decreasing our need for livestock farming.
Right.
There is an inflection point for renewables, for electrifying our grid. There's so many different things that we are just like, it's just like kind of how people say with voting, like it really, that's why it's a movement. It just, you'll just need a certain percentage to push it over to mass adoption. And that's massive.
Interesting. So pig farming is apparently a bad one, right?
I mean, their livestock.
All the livestock, yeah. Right? So I'm just thinking, I'm like, you know, like, this is a stupid point. I guess it makes no sense. But like, that's a silver lining to like certain religions becoming more and more pervasive. It's like specific religions don't eat specific kinds of meat, right? Should we all just become Muslims? Then no pigs? Come on, dude. Right. Colorado for president. All right. Sorry. Moving on. That was stupid. But I will say this. I've heard that people say that reducing kind of industrial scale farming would be the easiest way to make a big impact quickly. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think divesting from fossil fuels and and also
those are the two main ones, right?
Yeah. And changing industrial livestock farming for sure.
Cool. Yeah. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And yeah, it seems like there's progress with both of these things. Like you're saying, electric vehicle sales being way up. Great. And a lot more plant-based options becoming pervasive and popular. Great, right? These are all good things for masses to make slight changes to their lifestyle. But will that be enough on the current trajectory? Is there a chance that we're on pace to hit our goals? People seem skeptical about it. Like, what do you think? Do we need to make more radical change?
I mean, I think yes, but the skepticism is honestly just an excuse for people just to keep living their lives the way they want to live their lives. When people are skeptical, I'm like, you just don't want to change. It's like when like so many people, I guess, were in January, everyone sharing their New Year's resolution. They're like, I want a six pack and I'm going to be healthy. I'm going to go to the gym, whatever. And then it's like it changes within. That's why I'm like, human behavior, human psychology is a huge part of the climate movement. Because it's like, is your skepticism you actually being logical about it and knowing all the data and climate solutions that exist? Or is it you just so you could be skeptical and continue your comfortable life?
Right. Totally. Which is why
itself is a privilege. Yeah.
Interesting. So
I'm like, check yourself, you know?
Right. No, that's good.
I don't like have any sympathy for people who are like skeptical. I'm like,
no, totally. But
like, at least try. Like, no, even if it doesn't work, at least try. Like, obviously when you work out, you're not like, oh, overnight I'm going to have a six pack, but at least like try, go to the gym. So that's why with like people in the climate movement or anyone, I'm just like, at least try, do something.
Right.
It doesn't matter. I don't care.
Right. And you can be cynical. This is interesting too. So to your point, in a way, like cynicism is important maybe to help this movement because it's like people are vain pieces of shit. So like if you can tap into that and have it be useful for climate change, maybe that's good.
Yeah.
Climate is sexy. That could be good. Right. Like picture this, like the Earthshot Award becomes as popular as the Grammys or whatever. And suddenly we're on the red carpet and you're like, what are you wearing? Like you can be like Balenciaga and still be working toward helping the climate. What a wonderful world that would be. And to be honest, I'm much more interested in watching that than some rigged entertainment award show that no one gives a shit about, right? Especially me. You're going to tell me that so-and-so music is the best? Like, the Grammys are the worst one by far. Well, let's swap out the Grammys with the Earthshot Award, right?
Dad, let's do it.
Let's fucking do it, dude. That rules.
Sign our petition.
Sign the petition. Let's do it. Okay, so we're getting close to the end here. I want to make sure that I cover. Okay. I have a specific thing. And if there's anything else you want to add as well, put the cherry on top. That would be wonderful. It's been great having you. Thanks for coming on the show. Recycling. Recycling is like one of the earliest things that I can remember about like, it's good for the planet. As a kid, it was maybe the only thing that I would have ever thought of is it's important to recycle pollution, whatever, or not pollution, like garbage, landfills, like we can't, there's not space for all the trash. Let's recycle. Okay. How well are we doing with that? How important is recycling to these goals that we have? And how does one recycle properly?
Oh my gosh, such.
Sorry.
No, you think the thing is like you think they should be simplistic answers. Well, first off, guess who invented the recycling industry?
Coca-Cola?
Well, it was the plastics industry.
Okay.
So good,
thank you. Thank you. Decent guess.
Yeah. Ding, ding, ding. yeah, because basically the plastic industry was like, how do we make sure people buy more? We'll tell them that they're doing so good that they will dispose of it and they'll recycle.
Interesting.
And, you know, plastic executives have long known that plastics don't biodegrade ever.
Right.
Which is like insane. Microplastics are
ever. Yeah,
microplastics just become nanoplastics and it goes into our bloodstreams. It impacts everything. Yeah. Like just wait until you're trying to have a baby. Like it will literally impact
my baby's just going to come out in a plastic bottle.
Oh my God.
What the fuck? open it.
But that I'm not saying that to discourage people from recycling because like obviously recycle, it's more to show and really have people understand like how deep these systems are within capitalism. Like everything we think is helpful, beneficial, they were just all smoke and mirrors by the same
marketing
system.
Ploy.
Marketing ploys.
Interesting.
It makes us feel like we're doing something good, but Yeah. So recycling, it's, oh, that's a whole.
But isn't that the whole point of it? Since we can't get rid of it, we're going to reuse it. It doesn't work that way. It's not that
less
simple.
Less than 10% of all plastics is actually recycled.
I've heard that too. And then I've heard additionally that like preparing your recyclables is an important part of that. Is that true? Like washing it.
It depends on where you live and where you're. And also, I think what's important to know is that just for everyone listening, just simply Google, like, I live in Brooklyn and this word is my trash go, because no one knows where the trash goes. No one know. Also, Google where your water comes from, like what watershed. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to understand where our water comes from and where our trash goes. That's like just basic understanding of knowing that when we throw something away, it still stays on this earth and it completely impacts us. Mm-hmm. Or when we use water excessively, it comes from an actual source. That so I think connecting these dots is like a huge part of understanding our right. own climate impact. It's not to shame anyone. It's just like the more sense. Knowledge you have, the more information you know, the more you're like, oh, okay, I know where I exist and how I exist in these systems.
Right.
And right now I keep talking about these systems, and it's just the thing is that we live in the system. It's not like I could live outside the system and like be a nomad, but it's like understanding the smoke and mirrors and like what is actually like the right. truth within the systems. And that's how you can fight it.
Right. Like this is this way because this is that way. And that is that way. Understanding all of that can help shape one's decision-making process as far as whether or not their yeah. life is contributing to the problem or not.
Yeah. Like when you make any decision, you're like, oh, do you want to have this food or this food? And you're like, well, what's in this meal and what's in this meal? What are the ingredients? Right. Like, you just want to know, like, I'm like, if we know the information, then we can better understand and like tackle it. And also, I think during COVID, everyone was like, oh, humans are the virus. Look at nature healing, like right. dolphins in the Venice Canal, like nature is right. healing. Humans are the virus. And it's like, humans are not the virus. And that's also like humans, indigenous humans and humans ourselves. We have lived in tandem, in equilibrium, in symbiosis with nature for thousands of years. It's
point.
These systems that we live in that are the viruses.
The society.
It's capitalism, colonialism, overconsumption.
And like
those
you said, it's new and we're like learning our lesson now.
And we're learning a lesson. And we need good. And we need to like we need to basically know what the system is, you know? Like we keep using it's like we need to know that these exist for us to like even combat it.
Great. So, okay. So all good things. This is helping my general understanding, talking this out, all very helpful. Specific question. Is it possible to burn garbage for energy? Is that a thing? I've like seen that that's a thing. Is that not a thing?
It depends. I mean, it depends on what specifically are you talking about? Because that has.
I saw like an Instagram thing. It might have been bullshit. I don't know. Like you.
As like a climate solution.
Sure.
Because like, people burn garbage to, you know, like that's also a very common way to dispose of garbage in like certain countries. So
right. Which I know if you're just burning, and I've seen it in some certain like third world countries where they're just like burning a bunch of plastic. That smell is like. A scary one. It's like, oh Jesus, obviously
yeah,
that's not
and
good
emissions.
But can't you like capture the burning of it and make it, I don't know, did that technology exists, right? Is there a reason why that can't be more of a thing?
Yeah, apparently that technology exists and it should. Yeah, it exists. I mean, it's kind of like the same, like in Japan they figured out how to make human waste into drinkable water.
That's insane.
So it's like these and you think that these notions are insane and really radical, but if you look at the circularity of how nature works in itself, like if, you know, you were an animal and you die out in nature, you decompose and you go into the sea, into the soil, you become mycelium, then you go into the forest growth networks and you become nature again. It's circular. So it's not so insane where, you know, garbage can be then created as energy, and that does happen in nature. We're just using it in a very like
right.
obscure way.
Right. So the what I'm gathering is that all of these solutions working together are how we reverse this, the same way all of the problems that we are creating contributing to all this are working together. So like a combination of like figuring out how to take waste and make it energy and using less, transitioning into electric vehicles and more plant-based stuff. So there's less mass farming, whatever, like a little bit of all of that will contribute to our success.
Yeah, it's all of the above.
All of the above.
And that might be hard to swallow, but it's because we're literally going through the biggest societal and shift ever.
Right.
And so we need to change a little bit of everything.
Right. It's like, you know, like you said, on par with like an industrial revolution or just like a massive turning point in, you know, man-made society.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
So there's reason to believe, everybody, that we can make a change, and all the alarms being rung are being rung for a reason, so that we realize how important this all is. And hopefully, you know, if these changes continue to make these big, these kind of big benchmarks where it's like, instead of 20%, maybe next year it's 30% or electric vehicles or whatever, all that kind of stuff will contribute toward our success. And would that make somebody like you and an Al Gore happy potentially? Or are you still like, guys, it's too soon to be celebrating. We need to keep making progress.
Climate optimism goes hand with like urgency and outrage and all the other emotions. It's a choice, and it's something that, you know, it's more like if we completely divested from fossil fuels, yes, that would make myself and Al Gore very happy. Mm. That's not going to happen overnight, but that can definitely happen in our lifetimes, and it should, 1,000%. So, yeah, I mean, it's like we're fighting the good fight, and like, I'm like, yeah, put me out of a job. I don't want to be a climate journalist or...
Right.
You know, anymore, but
my
it's
work
also,
is done here. You ride off into the sunset.
I mean, I wish, beautiful. But it's just also, but it's also like having people understand that this is the fight for not just our lives, but it's like the fight for anything that we've ever known. And like, I refuse to, if I'm going to be alive at this point, at this juncture, like how insanely rare that we're alive at this point. Mm. I'm not going to let history be written in this way. And we all have autonomy over that.
Right. Well, cool. That's exciting. Let's, you know, take charge and grab our destiny by the cojones and all live a nice life on this planet for our generations to come.
We got a couple of facts.
Let's hit it. Let's
just to confirm
yes.
things that have been brought up. Oh. 44% of the world population doesn't have access to basic necessities. That was something that was brought up earlier. That's 3.5 billion people.
Jesus.
0.7% of the annual deaths in the world come from extreme heat or cold exposure.
Interesting.
And then you mentioned traffic jams in Indonesia. Mm. On July 8th, 2016, there was a traffic jam there that lasted 35 hours.
Jesus Christ. Facts of Ryan, everybody. Well, guys, that's Sophia Lee. Where can we find some of your work? Like, where should we be looking for your stuff?
I think Instagram is the easiest.
What's your Instagram?
It's at SOPHFEI, Sophie.
Cool. Love it. Awesome. Great.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on the show. This is great. This is so helpful.
Thank you.
I had a great time.
Amazing.
Appreciate it. So, yeah. Talk soon. Bye-bye.
Talk soon. TTYL.